listening to the Locked on Nuggets podcast, your daily podcast on the Denver Nuggets. Now, here is your host from DenverStiffs.com, Adam Mades.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to the Locked on Nuggets podcast, part of the Locked on NBA Network. I'm your host, Adam Mades, from DenverStiffs.com, the largest Denver Nuggets blog and community on the web. Check us out. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Check us out on DenverStiffs.com as well, as we've got our brand new Gary Harris, Gary's Army t-shirt up there. I think it's really, really cool. Ships in a week. Really great design. A lot of people saying it's their favorite one that we've done so far. Really cool. So check it out. Only $25. You're going to love it. Also, sign up using the Draft app. Download the Draft app for free. Use the promo code LONuggets, and tomorrow, actually when you're listening to this, it'll be Wednesday. So today, I'm going to challenge my listeners to a nice friendly game of daily fantasy sports. See if you can draft a better team than me. Last week, I took second, and it killed me. This week, I'm going to win. I promise you that. I'm joined today by a very special guest, somebody I've been looking forward to meeting for a long time, has been around basketball, the Nuggets, and just has an interesting perspective, I think, on life and basketball and all of the intersections therein, Dr. Travis Heath. Travis, thanks for joining me.
It's an honor, man, and it's crazy because, you know, we literally live like a two-minute car ride from one another. It's sort of ridiculous that we haven't gotten together yet, but as we were talking about before the show, you know, you have little kids running around. And
it's a game changer.
All bets are off.
Yeah, for sure. And we're 2 minutes away from each other and like 45 minutes away from every other part of civilization, which is what makes it all the more absurd.
This is true.
We live out in the boonies. No, but I'm really excited to have you on because I do think we have a lot of commonality. And we were just kind of getting to know each other before the show, and I wanted this to be, I thought it would be cool for us to kind of meet while also recording, and I thought it would be kind of cool, the different things we have to discuss. But first, just give me a quick overview of your background so listeners know your, you know, what you've done writing-wise and also work-wise in the NBA over the years.
Yeah, so I played college. Well, I didn't play college basketball. I sat on the bench and practiced really hard, so I wasn't very good.
Where at?
So I was at Gonzaga my freshman year, which everyone sort of goes, ooh, but what I discovered, this was 1998. It was the year they made that first run. I wasn't good enough to play there. That's what I discovered, yeah. Really. It's like, you know, I'm, you know, I thought I was pretty good playing high school basketball here in Colorado, but then realized, you know, those guys are pretty good. So, you know, I meddled through that for a bit and then came back to Colorado, not really knowing what I was going to do. I coached high school basketball for 2 or 3 years here in Colorado, and then started going to graduate school for psychology. As I'm working my way through a PhD program, I needed a way to make extra money. I needed something unorthodox that didn't have like normal hours because yeah. You're in school 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. sort of deal. So I stumbled across something, it's near and dear to my heart, hoopsworld.com, which Steve Kyler and crew ran.
Oh, okay.
I think from there went to, I don't know, it was a Basketball Insider's Net.
That's what it is now, yeah.
Yeah, there's like two or three iterations of that. But anyways, I somehow found Steve, and I started writing about the Nuggets in like 2005. And at that time, I think the first game I covered was in 2005. There was like no internet media there.
Right.
There was like the Denver Post, the Rocky Mountain News, the Boulder Daily Camera, and then like weirdo me.
Like people 20 and under are like, the Rocky Mountain News? What? What is this?
Right. Yes, there was once two newspapers in this town, and they neither was digital either.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was sort of a weird, it fit me perfectly. I was this weird internet guy that everyone's kind of like, what are you doing? And so I did that. And
how old are you at the time?
25. So this was 2005. And so I did that for a good 4 years probably and just met a lot of interesting people. And then, you know, I started as a professor and my time started to get a bit more truncated. It became clear I was going to have to pick one or the other, you know, either covering the NBA or being a professor, at which point, someone that worked for the Minnesota Timberwolves offered me a chance to be a consultant, which if you can ever be a consultant, I highly recommend it. It's the best gig ever because nobody knows what you do, yeah. Right? It's mysterious. So it was perfect. I did that, I want to say, for like about four years, maybe four and a half, something like that. Did all kinds of different things. I did some scouting, which was perfect. A lot of it was regional scouting, so I do college scouting.
Guys, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, the Pac-12, the Mountain West, and even, the Big Sky Conference that UNC's in. And at that time, you know, players like Rodney Stuckey and then later Damian Lillard were coming through. So it was
right.
Third conference to have here. So I did some of that. I did some other projects in terms of like media training with players and things of this nature. I've also done one-off projects here and there for teams. And so then 2013, I think, was the last year that I was, you're not a consultant full time, I guess, but like employed by a team, right? Like on the payroll. And then my wife had our first child. And at that point, I knew that I couldn't continue doing this, at least not right now, because too much travel, too much work, all that. So, that's kind of the Cliff Notes version of my experiences with basketball in the NBA.
It's interesting because you ended right as I was starting. Like 2014 was really my start, so it was a small gap, but kind of an interesting switch off there. I thought you were going to say something. So what all did you do when you were a scout? Was there also like some psychology stuff involved with it, or was it mainly just kind of watching the players live, watching film and giving reports?
Yeah, there's definitely psychology involved. So some of it was just traditional scouting, right? Writing scouting reports. And that part's fun because I love basketball. I love watching basketball. So that was easy. But, you know, I also did some like pre-draft stuff. There's personality assessments and things like that. You can also be part of interview processes and all those kinds of things. As a scout, though, what I found most interesting was talking to the people around the player. Like, I think you could learn a lot. Like, to me, that's a whole bunch of scouting, is trying to get context. Like, you know, especially in with synergy and all the stuff we have today, man.
Right.
Like, anybody can be a scout. Not to say you don't learn something by being on the ground, but I think most of what you learn is like data gathering, right? And I enjoyed that part, like talking to old high school coaches, talking to family members, like trying to do anything you could do through whatever channels you could.
But I want to know about that. I want to dig on this, because like, okay, you want to ask an uncle that's like very involved in the player's life about the player. Like, what, you walk up to a guy and say, hey, what can you tell me about your nephew?
Yeah. Well, see, I would, we were talking about this a little bit before the show. Like, I don't like talking in big groups of people, but I really love one-on-one conversations. So, you know, usually it would start like this. Usually I'd be talking to an assistant coach, right? And this assistant coach would have some bit of information. And assistant coaches in college like talking to anyone that's associated with anyone in the NBA, right?
Right.
And so, you know, it's easy to get information. But then, you know, if you're listening carefully, they're going to give you two or three other names, right? And often they can put you in touch with people. And it's sort of like a big puzzle then. You're kind of gathering different puzzle pieces. And you can talk to as many different people as possible, right? I love that part of it. Now, if I was on the other end of it, like, I wouldn't love recruiting. I wouldn't love being a college coach and having to recruit and go through all that. But from where I sat in the NBA, it was, and as a consultant, it's the best. Like, nobody really knew who I was. You know, I'd have the little lanyard or whatever that would say like Timberwolves on it. And so, okay. But nobody knew who I was. And it was like a sort of a mystery person that would come in and gather information and leave. So that part of it was, I actually quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, that sounds like fun, but it also does sound, you have to be a perceptive person, I feel, in order to do this job at a high level. Not just because, like you said, it's not always just what they say, but if you get conflicting reports, that's interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah, look, all this kind of subjective data gathering, I use the word puzzle, that's what it is. It's a gigantic puzzle. Like, not everyone's going to tell you the same thing. Right. And so then you have to try to assess sort of the credibility of the information. How sophisticated are the people that you're talking to? I mean, if they're very sophisticated, they know how to give you exactly what you're looking for.
Right.
So the conversation has to sort of take on a different tone. To me, it's not that different from what I do now in private practice as a psychologist, in that I'm really trying to get to know someone as authentically as I can. Now, if as a scout, what I'm doing is I'm trying to get to know that player, but to get to know that player, I may have to get to know people around the player authentically and form a good relationship. And then once you have that, they'll talk to you more genuinely, right? Yeah. And that's sort of something that builds up over time. So you're mentioning like the uncle is not, you know, you don't go up, hey, Uncle Chuck, you know, yeah. and all of a sudden Chuck just gives you the goods, right? It's sort of a relational building over time is how I would phrase right. it.
What kind of psychological evaluations do teams give players? I know that there's always these stories at the draft or you know, when they're working players out and they ask them absurd questions or try to get them off balance. Like, have you had any interaction with that? And like, what do teams try to do? Do they bring in sports psychologists during interview processes? And what's that like?
Yeah, sometimes they do. Some teams do. Sometimes some teams don't. Some NBA organizations are still very skeptical of any kind yeah. of psychology. It's like this, you know, we might as well be chasing ghosts or something weird, right? And some of it's this old school basketball mentality. I mean, think about how long it took analytics to sort of get right. going. But, you know, I think the sort of weird questions, I've seen that happen. I'm not a huge fan of that. I mean, I think you have to be like, look, these players are so well trained by the time they get to Chicago, right?
I don't think people understand this. And this might be a unique thing to the last 10 years, but yeah, these guys have been really coached on how to handle a lot of different types of interactions that it does feel very inauthentic. Even interviewing them in the locker room and stuff, sometimes you're like, wow, they're going through the playbook right now.
Yeah. I mean, there are entire like firms that train them on how to communicate, not only with the media, but also in these sorts of interviews. So they've been practicing it. So I'm not a huge fan of that. You know, there are all kinds of assessments that can be given. Sort of the gold standard in personality assessment is the MMPI, the Minnesota Multiphasic Inventory. The problem with this is it's 567 questions, and it takes like 3 to 4 hours to complete. Jeez. Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, you know, like if you have time with a player, chances are you don't want to have them spending most of that time doing an assessment. So then there are shorter assessments that can be done. But, you know, to be honest with you, the personality assessments to me are outside of the context of the person and their environment are pretty meaningless.
Okay.
I mean, let me put it this way. The personality tests, I think, are generally better at ruling out than ruling in.
Right.
Like, so you can, like, you could see some really big red flags right. where you're like, oh, okay, like, this person has some, like, highly antisocial tendencies, and perhaps that could manifest in right. them breaking the law in the future or something, right. and maybe they already have. And so, yeah, you can rule out, but you know, I like if you had an MMPI profile of Michael Jordan, I don't think you could then take that profile and match it to people that were coming in and go like, oh, this guy's going to be as good as Michael Jordan.
Right.
I think so, you know, they have some utility, but, you know, I still think that human interaction is such a major part of evaluating players. You know, I love advanced statistics, but I still think there's a human element to the game that we can't ignore, right? And I feel the same way, although I like quantitative data when evaluating personality of players, I still think that human interaction and being involved in human interaction is really important.
Do you see yourself playing armchair psychologist when you're watching the NBA? Do you ever catch yourself kind of watching guys and being like, I see some antisocial tendencies or poor leadership? And
that's a great question. It's strange. I think I almost unconsciously move in and out of those positions. Like there are times, because I love basketball. I love the Nuggets. I grew up in Denver. I mean, I love the Broncos, but the Broncos were always 1A. The Nuggets were always my favorite team growing up. I mean, back to the 80s, I would watch the Nuggets. So when I get locked into a Nuggets.
Yeah, right? Look at you. This You're is welcome. Great synergy. Right.
But when I'm watching a game and I really get just sort of engrossed in it, I'm just a fan. I'm just enjoying it. I'm, you know, probably like any other fan. Well, maybe less emotional than some people I've been seeing on Denver Stiff. Some of those
people
cats
get crazy.
They get wild. But you know what I'm saying. And then other times I sort of can. And I don't know what happens. Maybe there's some sort of visual or auditory cue, and it snaps me into sort of analyzing a bit more. So there are those moments when it happens, but it's not. I don't consistently watch games. I think I'd drive myself mad if I consistently watch games like that, you know?
Yeah, it's funny. I had a scout on the other day, and a couple months ago, actually, and he talked about how now he can't watch a game except for as a scout, and it's almost taken some of the enjoyment out of it for it. So, but it sounds like for you it's a little bit different. both from the scouting and the psychology, you can still turn off the brain and just kind of enjoy the basketball.
Yes, and I think that's probably because I have practiced doing that in my profession, right? Like, you know, I'm talking to people every day who have been through, you know, large-scale trauma, and if I were to take that with me and, you know, bring it everywhere with me, I would, you know, it wouldn't be good, right? I mean, it would be detrimental to me. So I think I have some practice in how to do that. And I, you know, basketball to me is fun. Now, when I, don't get me wrong, when I'm scouting, it's different.
Right.
Scouting is work. I mean, I don't, I didn't catch, I've caught a lot of the episodes, but I didn't catch the episode. I know the one you're talking about with the scout.
His name's Steve Jones.
Yeah. I'll have to go back and listen to that and see what he says. But scouting is a lot of work. I mean, it can be a labor of love, but like, I think a lot of people who might want to be scouts will look at that and go like, oh, you just get to watch basketball.
Right, right.
No, you're watching by the time you're done scouting, like I would feel completely out of energy, right? Like,
right.
Because it would require all of my mental capacity to sort of analyze what's going on. Whereas when I'm just watching a game for fun, I mean, I usually, unless the Nuggets are getting hammered, I usually feel more energized by the end of it, right?
Yeah.
And I think for the Nuggets especially, just because it's my boyhood favorite team, maybe it's harder to do that. But and I also scouted a lot of college. I don't watch a ton of college basketball because I think it's more likely to get me into that mode of – and plus, Adam, I'm just – like I'm a weird – guy this way. I stopped at the rec center over there. I stopped a game the other week because these kids were playing. They're shooting like 40-foot threes, and I literally stopped the game and I started coaching these kids. My wife was like, "You're sick. Like you're out of your mind." So don't get me wrong. There's a part of me that definitely still has that if I'm not careful.
That's too funny. I think for me, I always watch the games twice. I mean, partly this is my job, and people are tuning in for my analysis. The first time is almost always taking the game in, just like a broad perspective. Like, and sometimes I'll go back and watch it and be like, man, my first impression was actually wrong. But I don't know. So it's almost like I think sometimes it's best to watch the game two different ways, for at least for a guy like me. And I'm not good enough as a scout to be able to just like watch 5 minutes of a clip and really dissect everything that's going on the court. It takes me multiple viewings.
Well, I guess I wasn't that good of a scout either, because it would always take me multiple viewings, right? You know, games I would be at live, I would always be watching that film, usually with later that night when I came home. Yeah. So I just think that's, look, I mean, I don't think you'd have to be pretty arrogant to believe you'd catch everything one go-round, right? Like
I didn't know, so I feel much better now. I was a little bit worried.
Hey, sometimes I'd watch games three or four times, to be honest with you, especially if there was a player I was really focused on, you know, because the good thing when you're there in person is you get an idea of like size and speed and like I remember when San Diego State played Colorado State up in Fort Collins, I was sitting about 45 minutes before the game, sitting next to the court watching Kawhi Leonard, and I saw his hands and I was just like, oh my God. If you haven't seen him in person, it looks like a cartoon character or something. Like, and I'm sure I was creeping him out because I was like 15 feet from him and I was just staring at his hands, and I'm talking to the guy next to me. I'm like, I swear those are the biggest hands like I've ever seen in my life. And then I saw that, and often guys with huge hands, disproportionate hands for their size, especially, struggle shooting the ball. Right. Yeah. So I was like, that guy's never gonna be able to shoot. Shows you what kind of scout. I said, hey, that guy can defend. He's going to be a great defender in the NBA. He'll be good in transition, right? He can rebound the ball. He's got good instincts. I don't think he'll ever be a shooter.
Well, just about everybody missed on that one, so you can you can forgive yourself a little bit. So this is kind of a broad one, but what do you think are the most important personality or character traits, if you could narrow it down to like a few things for a successful NBA career?
That's a good question. I think some of it depends on, well, I think there's some characteristics that are good for everyone who's going to stick in the league,
right?
But I think sometimes it depends what lane you're going to be in the league too,
right?
Like, for example, obviously having some level of resilience, perseverance, work ethic. I mean, these things are universal. And by the way, I think that can apply to any profession, right? But what's more interesting to me is looking at the lane the player is going to be in. So if a guy is going to be, like in baseball, they talk about like a utility infielder, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's quite a basketball equivalent, but, you know, role player, that sort of person. Adaptability, I think, then is really important, right? Being adaptable, because if you're a role player, you're probably going to be on multiple different teams.
Yeah.
You're probably going to be put in a lot of different positions and systems. So I really want to see adaptability. And adaptability, like, there's actually ways you can look at this in terms of how a person thinks. Some people become very rigid in their thinking. Some people can much more easily be flexible in the ways in which they think, right? Now, adaptability is great for a role player. For your superstar player, I mean, you know, look at the personalities of most superstar players. They're pretty rigid. They're almost rigid to a fault. Yeah. But it helps them because they're so confident that, you know, that the way they do it will be good. Now, that it's not easy to coach that player, right? How many times have we seen that player? Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant,
LeBron, even
LeBron. I mean,
a lot of these guys.
Absolutely. But, you know, that's sort of the price you pay for greatness, I suppose. Right.
It is tough because there are so many NBA players that think that they are that guy, that misestimate who they are. And it's really hard to get your role player not to have that Mamba, quote unquote, Mamba mentality.
Yeah.
When his role is different.
You bring up the Mamba mentality thing. And
I have it down here as a thing, a specific thing I wanted to ask you.
Oh, great.
What do you think of Mamba mentality?
It was the summer of 2008, I want to say. Maybe 9. I don't know. Somewhere around then. I had the chance to spend some time with Kobe Bryant. I was living in Los Angeles at the time. And I don't want to say we became like best friends or anything, but I got to spend some time around him, some one-on-one time. And that guy, like, we always hear about work ethic.
Right.
And I've seen a lot of professional athletes, and I've seen a lot of work ethic. But that dude is insane. Like, in fact, I remember telling his trainer at the time, I was like, oh, this is unsustainable. Unsustainable straight to the Hall of Fame, right? Like, I think that for him, it worked really, really well. But I still think that mentality, this sort of dark, cutthroat. I mean, I don't, you know, I watched one of his, like the cartoon.
Right.
Thing.
Yeah.
You know,
the Muse Cage. Yeah.
What do you call it? Muse?
Well, I don't call it any. He calls it Muse Cage.
Muse Cage.
I call it what he calls it, which is Muse Cage.
Good. He might come after you. See, to me, I think that's just fine for some players, but I don't think that's the way that everybody has to be. Like, we were using the word authenticity earlier. And so when I'm working with players, what I want to know is what gives them meaning and purpose, right? How is it that they most effectively exist in the world? And I want to help the player find ways to bring that into whatever sport it is they're playing, okay? So, like, you know, Nikola Jokic, I don't want him to be like Kobe Bryant.
Right.
I don't want him to have Mamba mentality because that's not how he's wired.
Right.
Right? And so, like with Jokic, people say, oh, he's not shooting enough. And we could go down a whole thing with Jokic. I'm not sure I even agree with that,
right,
by the way, that he's not shooting enough sometimes. There's been moments, but okay, so then people go, well, he needs to be a killer, I think, but he's not that.
Right.
And so what you do then with Jokic is you appeal to his sense of teamness, the collective, right?
Right.
That's motivating for him. If you would have done that with Kobe Bryant, I'm not sure that would have been as motivating for him. And that's what I mean when finding, like, you know, how does a player understand and exist in the world? And then how can you take that and use it as an asset when playing basketball? So, the whole Mamba mentality thing, what I don't like is how it's being portrayed as like a one size fits all. Like, you must do this to be successful. I mean, that's crazy to me because we can be successful in many, many different ways. Look at any profession. Now, some ways are more popular. Like to be successful the way Kobe Bryant is successful will get you more endorsements.
Right.
I bet you'll sell more shoes and all that stuff.
Well, I think Nike invented this myth with Michael Jordan. I mean, they really tied the extreme work ethic thing to Michael, and it was like, this is a virtue, a universal virtue.
Oh, I love your language, universal virtue. And maybe there are some universal virtues, but when we're looking at a basketball player capitalizing on their potential, I want to know their idiosyncratic virtues.
Right.
I want to know the virtues that are specific to them and how they understand them. And by the way, there are quantitative assessments character strength assessments that you can use, and you can sort of discover. And sometimes for players, they're sort of already like, oh, I already knew that about myself. Other times they're a little surprised. But once you know, say, their top five character strengths, then you can take those and you can sort of map out a way that they can authentically be successful, right?
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, the Mamba mentality, that's fine. I mean, it's one way to be successful, but if we really went back and looked over the years at, especially pre-Nike and you know, ways in which people were successful, I suspect we'd see many different ways. And by the way, we know this about the world, Adam, like trends come and go, right? I mean, I imagine that this Mamba mentality is sort of where we're at now. I don't know if it'll be where we're at forever. Now, I'm not saying, of course, don't have work ethic. It's just that work ethic, like some guys who work really hard don't have this outwardly maniacal sort of presentation of it. It doesn't mean they're not working hard. Like, I remember George Karl told me these stories. He used to get furious at Ray Allen when he coached him for the Bucks because Ray Allen wouldn't sweat. Like, they would, they'd run a couple suicides and he'd be like, he's not running hard, right? We're doing a third one. And it's just because Ray had this sort of smooth way of, now Ray has a great work ethic, almost obsessive work ethic, but the way that he presents is not the way that Jordan and Kobe presented.
I'll take it a step further. And hard work is a given. We're not critiquing hard work. It's this idea that Mamba mentality encapsulates a whole lot of other things. And there's a story about Jordan in 2008 or 2010 when he was on the Olympic team. And calls a trainer up at 2 in the morning, says, hey, I'm trying to get some shots up. And the trainer comes to the gym and they work out for 3 hours together. And the trainer goes home, comes back to practice at 10, and says, hey, I'm so tired. What time did you get to bed? And Kobe says, I didn't. I was here all night long, all the way till today, never slept. And people hail this as the virtue of this thing. And I always wonder, I think that was a mistake for Kobe. This mentality in general, because you think about what Team USA has meant to so many players, and I'm not talking about the patriotic angle of it. I'm talking about the professional. People develop. They steal from other players. They're out playing cards and going to the casino, and this is like a really important time for them to learn. I think Kobe needed some of that. I think he needed a few extra card games and a few extra casino nights with his teammates, because that probably would have done more for him than those extra 5 hours of basketball. What do you think of that?
I think it's an interesting perspective, and I think now we're delving into the idea of relationships and relationships with teammates. And, you know, sometimes those guys who have this quote-unquote Mamba mentality struggle in relating to their teammates. We know this was true with Jordan in a lot of different ways, right? I've heard similar stories about Kevin Garnett. I mean, Kevin Garnett was out of Minnesota by the time I passed through, but I've heard some stories about KG over the years. And so, you know, I mean, look, I was watching, when did the Nuggets play the Timberwolves? They played them like twice or whatever in the last couple of weeks, and I was watching Thibodeau, right? I thought to myself, dude, that guy is like the coach version of Mamba mentality, right?
And sleeps probably 2 hours a night, I would guess, on average.
And he looks horrible. Look at him, and I'm not saying this to be funny. Like, I want him to be physically healthy, but I'm worried for like his physical well-being. And I think, so the idea of athletes, but then also athletes as people. And so they need things outside of sports, relationships. They need sleep. They need hobbies. Right. I mean, all of these things that make us human, I think sometimes we forget about that with athletes. You know, even when I've consulted with teams, the idea of like, oh, we want you to come in and do a bunch of mental conditioning. I'm like, listen, do you know how much conditioning of this, that, or the other these athletes are already getting? Now you want to do mental conditioning?
Like,
maybe some of that.
Right.
But how about, you know, just cultivating their interest beyond the game? And this freaks out front offices and things like, oh, they got to be. I thought, listen, like, take any other profession. If you're working at it 96 hours a week, not only are you not going to perform at your best, right, but you're going to burn out and resent it.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at research, the research says we shouldn't be working more than about 35 hours a week. If we're working more than about 35 hours a week, there's a point of diminishing returns in our efficiency. You know, so I'm willing to move that number a bit depending on one's personality, but I think it speaks to the idea that we have to be a whole person to perform at our best.
I think this is like right up my alley in terms of like life philosophies. And one of the things I really believe is that there's two things. One, I think people learn best when they teach themselves, when they're put in a position for them to figure things out on their own. And then two, I think being able to apply lessons across disciplines is like the true measure of genius. And what I mean by that is like, I think basketball players can become better basketball players by reading books and like doing completely non-basketball related things, because you learn lessons in those. And if you can apply them and say, oh, you know what, this thing that I learned about cooking actually kind of applies to that team, and like that's true genius. And this is why I think that players, you mentioned hobbies, I think it's true of people in life. Just the more hobbies you can have, even if you have one passion that surpasses all hobbies, the more things you have kind of around that, I think the better.
Yeah, you know, I was telling you that time I spent in Los Angeles, and it's a long story, but I came into knowing Phil Jackson. One of his daughters is actually a therapist, and long story. But that was part of the genius of Phil Jackson, is that he didn't think about basketball all the time. He was, yes, it might have been weird that he was, you know, burning incense in the locker room and these sorts of things, but he was bringing players books. I mean, I think Popovich the same way, right? Yeah. He's inviting political discussions and things with players. I think this does a number of different things. One thing it does from a coaching perspective is it shows, hey, I care about you as more than just, you know, a vehicle for me to get paid.
Right.
I care about you as a human being. Yeah. And I think that that's a big deal. Also, I think it has, you know, the added benefit of players play better, in that, you know, for anyone that's listening to this right now, think about, no matter how much you might love your job, imagine if that's all that you did. Like, we do this weird thing. I mean, maybe not you and I specifically, but I mean the sports viewing public, where we expect athletes to be training like all the time. You know, if they, you know, if they put something on Instagram or whatever, I don't even have Instagram, but Twitter's the only one I have. But, you know, we're sort of like, oh, you should be working at, like, we wouldn't apply that to anyone else, right? Or I can't think of many others we'd apply that standard to.
To the accountant. You should be doing taxes right now. What are you doing on vacation?
Right.
Do you not care about your taxes?
Right. It's a crazy thing to me. And so I just think, you know, as a psychologist, part of my perspective is looking at the whole person. And I think the NBA is starting to do that. But I still think there's some room to go. Like, you know, the old school idea there, like, there are things we can take from the old school that I think are great in terms of informing work ethic and so forth. But, you know, part of what makes the old school old is that we've developed some new and sometimes better ways of doing things. I think sometimes pro sports franchises are a little bit slow in adopting some of those things. And, hey, maybe that's understandable. If you've done something for 30 years and you've had a decent amount of success, you know, it could be scary to change it.
I think the larger and more successful the institution, the more difficult it is for change. Because you've had so much success at something, it's how do we filter in these new ideas? But I love it. Move on to some Nuggets stuff here, because I'm really interested in your take on this current Nuggets roster, and I guess I'll throw out some players, and you could just kind of tell me what you think of them. First, Nikola Jokic.
I mean, I love Jokic. I think listening to some of the podcasts, Adam, I think you and I are similar in this regard. I am such a skills whore. And maybe it's because, you know, I was at best an average athlete. I'm a 5'10 point guard. Like, the only way I could survive playing basketball was to know the game, right? And to be smart about how I played. And so that's probably where my bias comes from. But Jokic then is right up my alley. I mean, he's incredibly skilled. I think the future is so bright for him. I'm not nearly as down on him as most people seem to be. Like, people are expecting a triple-double from him every night, this kind of crazy stuff. And, like, you know, he's a 22-year-old kid living in a foreign country with the weight of these expectations. I mean, he's still, what, at like 16, 10, and 5 or whatever the heck he's at, which, you know, still puts him in the upper echelon of centers. I will acknowledge that Jokic is very demonstrative non-verbally.
Yep.
And I think that's something that you were talking about when I go into psychologist mode. Yeah. I go that way with Jokic, whether it's good or bad. Like, there are times, man, like, and I know this, like physically this can't be done at this pace all the time. I understand that a human being doesn't have the energy to do it. But like Jokic, you've seen him sprint in the front court with the ball. He sprints forward sometimes and initiates the offense, and I'm just looking at the way he holds his body. I'm like, wow, this is going to be a good night for him and the Nuggets. And then there are other nights he's sort of like Gumby, right?
Yeah.
And, well, I'm making these movements. No, that's a really great pod, isn't it?
No, he's doing a very good Gumby, though. It's a very good Gumby.
But like, you know, and I can just go, oh, okay, he's somewhere on planet Jokic right now. He's not in. So I'll acknowledge that I see that stuff. And perhaps more with him just because he's so expressive non-verbally, but he's 22 years old. So I temper all of this with he's 22 years old. He's learning not only how to be a professional, but he's learning how to be the guy.
Right.
Right. And so I don't know. I'm still very high on him. Maybe I'm just seeing online and on Twitter and all of this the people that complain, you know,
the
squeaky
complaining
wheel gets
voices
the grease.
Are always the loudest. I really don't think there's a big section of it. I think it's a very loud minority of people that sound the alarm every time he has 5 points.
That's actually, I hope that's the case, because I think he's such a special player at 22 years of age. The way that he's perfect for the new school, in my opinion, and where the NBA is, and also where I happen to think it's going to continue going. So I feel like he's a legit star. And by the way, part of the reason his numbers are down, the numbers that are down, if you look at some of the advanced metrics,
right,
they're
actually
up.
Yeah.
Right. But if you're looking,
so funny.
I know, but if you're looking at points per game and you're why is that down? Or some games you'd have 18 rebounds and you
or even
eight
points
now.
Per 36 if you like want to like get
right.
fancy.
Right, there you go. Like part of that is because Gary Harris and Jamal Murray are assuming more of the burden offensively. And so ultimately, I think that's a good thing for this team, not to mention the first 20 games or whatever it was. He was trying to learn how to play with Paul Millsap. So anyway, I'm still very high on Jokic. I think he's just fantastic.
It is interesting about the physical stuff, the nonverbals, because he is a player that I think is exceptionally expressive, and I think also exceptionally moody, to be quite frank. I do think he's a guy that that rides the highs and lows. You said both good and bad. And I wonder, with the risk of sounding maybe prejudiced or something here, we have a lot of Serbians that have started following the site and following me personally, and they have said as much, that Serbians are emotional people. They like that they ride the highs and lows. And I always wonder if there's a cultural aspect to the passion, both the good and bad passion that comes with it.
I had never thought of that. That's so fantastic to hear you hypothesize about that. Isn't that interesting, right?
I think it is. And you think this could be I don't think it's it sounds like a bad thing. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I think all emotions have to be harnessed properly and so forth. But like you think about Darko, and this was sort of him as well. He was a very skilled player, but a bit of a hothead whose emotions controlled him. Both good and some good, but mostly bad in Darko's case. I don't think Jokic and Darko are the same person by any means, but I wonder if there's a common thread there, at least a little bit.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And then, so I think from a psychological perspective, what you look at with that, this is Jokic. He is authentically emotional, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So that has to be a part of his profile. Now, I'm not saying you can't tweak that. I'm not saying that you can't bring it to his attention, right, that emotion X, Y, and Z right now are getting the better of him, right? And I think the way that, again, from the outside looking in, I don't know Jokic. I've never met the guy, but the way that I do it is look at the collective and say, okay, when this emotion gets the better of you and it leads to you doing the famous Jokic, I'm going to grab a guy, after a turnover because I'm frustrated foul, right? Or where he gets a technical foul when he's all demonstrative with the referees, going, okay, does this serve the collective? Right. How is this impacting your teammates? I'm not sure it would be so effective to go personally and go, well, what's this doing for you? Because I think, yes, he's emotional, and he's also extremely collective. And George Karl used that word teamness.
Yeah,
I think Jokic embraces that. So how do you combine this tremendous care for the team and the collective outcome with these emotions. Like, man, that would be a fun project to take on. Yeah. I mean, because Jokic, I mean, how many people are more demonstrative in the NBA than him? There aren't many, right?
DeMarcus Cousins is up
There's
there.
One. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. But there are very few. I'm with you on that.
But DeMarcus does it in an angrier way, doesn't
yeah,
he?
For sure.
And the way Jokic does it, it's this, sometimes it's this goofy, funny way. Sometimes it's intense. And then sometimes it's a little mopey.
Yeah,
right?
For sure.
Yeah.
There's a video of Jokic playing ping pong with one of the assistant trainers or whatever, and like it's the same thing that you see with the referees. He's arguing every little point is like a 5-minute argument, and I was just like, I think this is just who Jokic is. He likes to argue the yeah. no matter how big or small. What about Gary Harris and Jamal Murray? What are your takes on the young backcourt?
Love Gary Harris. I loved him coming out of Michigan State. I didn't think Brian Shaw gave him much of a shot, but also, you know, maybe there were reasons for that. I don't know, Brian, but maybe there were reasons why he didn't.
Could have been good for him, too.
But yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Like, that could be, when we look back 15 years from now, that could be a key point in his narrative. I agree with that.
I sometimes wonder about Moutier in that regard, and it was mm-hmm. kind of the opposite. I mean, everything was given to him right away.
That's a really, okay, we're going to have to talk about that in a second. We'll have to talk about Moutier, but
okay.
Harris just keeps getting better and better in ways that, if I'm being honest, I didn't think he would get better and better. And
yeah,
I mean, I you know, if my ego were talking, I'd want to say, oh, I saw this coming all along. No, I liked him coming out of Michigan State, but I thought he'd be, you know, a solid starting two guard,
yeah.
right? Solid. You know, maybe if all things went right one year, he could challenge for an all-star berth, maybe. But
yeah.
more just that solid guy. But you watch him offensively now. Like, of course he could shoot the three. He's been doing that for a while. But the way he's driving to the basket now, the way he comes off some of these screens, and it's almost what I'm sort of a footwork. I just adore footwork. But you watch the way he comes off some of those screens. He's already got his feet positioned such that he can go straight to the rim.
Yeah.
These kind of one-handed finishes that yeah. he's doing now, almost mini Dr. J-esque finishes, just incredible. He's great in the passing lanes defensively. I think as a on-ball defender, I thought he dropped off a little bit last season, and there's been times where he's gone in and out of that, but I think he has the potential to be really good. I mean, and then the fact that he plays so well off of Jokic. I mean, what more,
right.
what more could you want from him?
Perfect pairing, really, in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. And then Murray, I'm so glad that Jamal's coming on, because I was I vociferously defended him a lot, because I just thought he would be
yeah.
his stroke's too perfect to not for him to not shoot the ball well. And
it
I
was
just,
weird that he wasn't shooting threes well last year.
And the beginning of this
and
year.
The beginning of this year, yeah.
Yeah, I watched it and I just thought, that stroke is out of a textbook. Like, it has to turn around.
Yeah.
Again, we've been talking about age. He's 20 years old. He's a kid.
So young.
And I think Michael Malone can be hard on him sometimes, and I'm not always against that either. I think
right.
there are times, and Jamal seems pretty tough mentally that way, so maybe he can take
some
of it.
I think he's a guy that thrives off of that.
That yeah, you would know better than I would, but from the outside looking in, that's what it looks like. And, you know, his what Jamal and Gary's doing some of this, and of course Jokic to a certain extent in the post can do some of it, but Murray can be that guy when the shot clock's going down that can create his own offense. And the Nuggets, I mean, really, it's probably been since like Chauncey and Carmelo that
yeah.
they, I mean, maybe the Iguodala year. I mean, Iguodala could do some of that, but he always wasn't always looking to score. He was looking to create for others. But
right.
you know, really, probably a legit end a shot clock, create your own shot kind of guy. We have to go back to Chauncey and Melo. And so Murray can be that guy. I was so excited about his defense early on in the year. It's dropped off precipitously, perhaps. I haven't looked at the metrics in a little bit, but I don't know if they'll be as kind. And I think Paul Millsap probably had a lot to do with
yeah.
that. He's a defensive anchor. But what I'm saying, like, I watched him on the ball, and like, I love how he would get down in his stance and he'd challenge guys. And
he tries.
I thought, like, man, if he can even be, like, average to above average
right.
on the defensive end,
right?
Like, he's legit all-star caliber point guard.
I mean, Steph Curry is the point guard on the best defense over the last 4 years, and he's a good but not outstanding defender. It's not like the ink you say, oh, we're going to build a defense around
right.
Steph Curry.
Right.
But and if Jamal Murray can be that guy, I think his offense can reach levels that more than make up for being an average defender or slightly above average defender, for sure.
Those three guys we've talked about, Adam, I think all three of them can be, I mean, we always talk about big threes in the NBA.
Yeah.
I mean,
is that a big three?
I think those guys can legit be a big three. When you look at their ages, what, Harris is 23, I think. Is that right?
22 or 23.
Yeah. Jokic, I know, is 22, and Murray, I know, is 20.
Yeah.
I mean, so they're you know, still moving up, right? They're not anywhere close to their prime. So I think those three guys, you can build around them for a really long time to come. Honestly, I couldn't be more excited about how those three guys are playing. And I wish Nuggets fans would enjoy the process a little bit.
Isn't this so true? This is such an interesting thing. I'm going to couch that because I want to ask you. Like, we're going to close with some sadly big baller brand stuff, but we're not going to talk about them specifically, more about the cultural environment in which they have sprung forth. But I also want to talk about that aspect. Moutier, what's your take?
Yeah. I mean, I loved Moutier, to be honest with you, because of his playmaking skills.
Same.
And I thought he would be really good. I mean, his game was a little different, but in terms of how he sensed the game, I saw Jason Kidd in that. If you watched him in pick and rolls in Summer League, that first Summer League, which isn't always a good gauge, I understand. But even the beginning of his first year in the NBA, some of the, like, his vision, his instinctual vision was incredible. And it's like that's all disappeared. And this has got to be complicated. I'm not here to give you one reason why.
Right.
I wonder about, you brought up a great point that he was just anointed the starter from day one, which there are pros and cons to that. On one hand, get him in there, you know, either learn how to swim or drink the pool. You know, he's going to figure it out one way or the other. You know, that's one school of thought, but also, you know, young players can be broken by that sometimes. To me, it's so much of it is in his head. Like so many of the turnovers, it seems so psychological. He's not playing the game, and then everyone's going like he should be in an attack mode and all that. And I go like, no, I just be you. Like just play the game the way that you play. And I just think he's been so mind screwed by all of this that I don't know that I'm pretty certain it's not going to happen in Denver. I hope if he goes somewhere else, I mean, I'm not one to root against the kid. I hope he'll find success somewhere else. And I don't know, maybe I'm just wrong. Maybe everything I was seeing was a mirage and I'm just trying to protect my own pride and defending this. I don't know, but man, just his court vision seemed special to me, and the fact that that's all but evaporated is befuddling.
I feel the exact same way. When I watched him in Summer League and watched him as a prospect his first year, I thought the passing is the thing and the vision is going to be the thing. And you look at him now and he's kind of a scorer. He's a scoring point guard, and it's like
that's not even his best suit.
Right, it's not. Yeah, it's definitely not.
I mean, he's strong and he can get to the rim and all that stuff, but and you know, I want him to be good. I want to try to defend him, but what my eye tells me and what the stats tell me is that, I mean, he is near the bottom of everything.
What I always tell people, because people, I've been called a Moutier hater. I was a huge Moutier fan his first year. I think the way I would put it is I really want him to succeed. I'm just not willing to let the Nuggets, I'm out of, I if I were the Nuggets, I wouldn't give him any more chances to. And unfortunately, that's kind of where we're at. So
agreed.
So I would love to see him go somewhere far east, maybe Orlando or somewhere like that, where it would be kind of fun to follow a resurgence for him.
Mm-hmm.
What about Michael Malone?
Yeah, I was a proponent of him getting the job.
He was your guy, right?
Back I liked him.
After George Karl.
Yep, I liked him. I actually wanted him to get the job the first time instead of Brian Shaw, to be honest with you. And I liked him because I thought he could bring both offense and defense.
Right.
I mean, he was known as a defensive. Sometimes I think these labels coaches get are a little ridiculous. Like,
they're
we're in the NFL and they're actually offensive coordinating and that's all they do. So I think that's a little overblown. But, you know, look, Michael Malone, he knows basketball. He's been around the game his whole life. I like his passion. I think sometimes, you know, what suits you best is also your worst enemy. And sometimes Michael Malone's passion, I think, bubbles over a little too much. But, you know, I'd rather have that than a guy who has no passion. I think if you were to ask me this question coming into this season, I would say offensively, I thought Malone and his staff did a wonderful job. Defensively, what's going on? How did it get this bad?
Right.
Now it's evened out a little bit, and it hurts that they don't have Millsap. And when they get him back, I think they can be at least an average defensive team.
Right.
But then it was backwards because their offense took a step back at the beginning of the year. Is that all Millsap? And I don't mean to blame all of this on Malone, but I guess, look, I feel pretty good about Malone. That's how I'll say it. I don't feel great. I'm not thinking like he's the coach for the next decade and he's going to bring title after title to Denver. But I also don't think he's a horrible coach. It's the nature of coaching in the NBA that fans are going to get on you. And, you know, one night you're a hero and the next night, you know, you're terrible and all that stuff. But overall, I think he's a solid coach. I would like to see him. I remember having these conversations with George Karl. So much easier said than done what I'm about to say. And I think he's probably, I'm just thinking about it in my head right now, I think he's probably done this more often than not. It's just the times that he doesn't, I see it and it bugs me. I'd like to see him be really thoughtful about potentially kicking players under the bus after certain losses. Like,
you think he does do it and he should not?
I think there are times that he does that to players that I don't know if they can take it. Like a guy, like to me, it's that, not that you never do it, but like a Jamal Murray, can he take it? Okay, he probably can.
Yeah, I think so.
I do too. I've seen him be hard on Jamal Murray, and there are times, and you might know this better than I see it and I go like, ooh, that was rough. Like, did you need to do that publicly? But then I thought to myself, like, I don't know. Maybe he knows something about Jamal Murray, and this serves his purpose, right?
Yeah.
So these are the things that I watch, and sometimes I kind of grip my teeth as I hear him talking. But then I acknowledge I don't know the individual personalities, and if Malone is being thoughtful about the players that he calls out because he believes that, based on their sort of psychology, that this is a good motivational tactic for them, I'm all for it. If it's because he's sort of losing his head a bit, like sometimes at the end of games, I see him, he gets so emotional, which there's a part of that I love.
Right.
There's another part of it where I'm like, whoa,
yeah.
Like he's jumping on the sidelines and I'm thinking like, okay, like take a deep breath. You know what I mean?
That's like college coaching. Like every college coach has that where you're screaming for 40 minutes. And
right. Which to me is always ridiculous. I had a friend of mine, he worked in the NBA 30 years and he would say, we were at a summer league. I won't disclose the coach. I don't want to throw anyone under the bus, but we're watching the summer league coach. And he looks over at me. He's like, man, what the hell is this guy doing? Like, what's he trying to prove? Jumping around like this, right? That all he's showing is that he has no confidence.
Yeah.
Okay, I could see that. I think Malone does have confidence in his coaching ability. I just think sometimes he gets a little emotional. One other thing I'll say about Malone.
He might be secretly Serbian. We don't know it.
Maybe he is. Well played. The one thing that has bothered me this morning, off-season sort of thing, is the turnover in assistant coaches. I don't know what that's about. And maybe there's a good reason for it. I don't know. But that from the, again, completely outside looking in, I look at that and I'm like, okay, what's going on there? Are there relational conflicts? Is he not getting along with some of these guys? And some of the coaches that he's lost were damn good assistant coaches by all accounts that were really helping. So anyways, I'll just throw
the optics of that I think are bad. But again, I talked about this one time on the show. I don't know if that's, is it money, you know, that the assistant coaches aren't making enough money? Is it relationships? Is it, you know, I don't know, unfortunately, and I haven't really heard anything on it. I want to wrap up by asking you something I think you're uniquely positioned to talk about. And that is today, I don't want to make this about LeVar Ball and the Big Baller family. I want to make it about the society in which this is kind of evolved in. But today they debuted, the Ball brothers made their debut in Lithuania, and over 100,000 people tuned in on Facebook. And of course, one of the controversies over the last few days has been ESPN's running these stories. And really the question I want to ask you is, what is it about this moment in time that makes these sort of people successful at grabbing our attention? And LeVar Ball, say what you will about him, has grabbed the attention of everybody and has made himself a story. But what is it? I think there's a lot of similarities between LeVar and Trump in they don't care if they're despised, loved, or whatever. They're winning because we all respond and interact with them.
Can I just drop the mic and leave? Like, what you just said was great. No, I think now why are we at that point? That's an interesting conversation to have, because I accept your premise completely. That, you know, in some ways, and I'm not trying to bash explicitly Trump or LeVar Ball here, but we're parents of young children, right? Like, sometimes children just want attention and they don't care how they get that attention, whether it's by sort of quote unquote good behavior or bad behavior. Now, I think LeVar Ball and Trump are more sophisticated than that, but you know, it's attention by any means necessary. Now, how have we gotten that way? I think, like anything, it's probably multifaceted. The sort of social media environment that we live in, right? Like, it's sort of how can I do something that makes a splash?
Yeah.
Right? No matter what that is, if it makes a splash, then it's quote unquote good. And it's good to my bottom line, whether my bottom line is dollars or whether my bottom line is likes and retweets. Right. I don't know what you call them in the other platforms. I'm not on those. Twitter. Thank God Twitter's the only, or maybe not.
Yeah, might be the worst one, quite frankly.
Twitter's the only one I'm on. But I think there's just this sort of, I'll put it this way. There was a woman I was speaking with in my practice, and I'll be very vague purposefully because I can't breach confidentiality, but she was like 15, young woman. And she said, you know, like, I want to be famous when I grow up. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. Like, well, what do you want to do? She's like, I want to be famous. And, you know, I was like, okay, I'm not getting it. So I asked her again. And then it took me two or three times to realize that was the end.
Right.
Like, you know what I mean? that she wasn't going to do anything to be famous,
right.
That her goal was to be famous. And if we're trying to describe the whole LeVar Ball Trump phenomenon, I mean, I think I would start there. Like, you know, look, we could say it's ridiculous that an actor or an actress gets paid $50 million for a film, or a basketball player gets paid $80 million, but they're doing something. They're producing something in the world, right?
Right.
But now this idea that fame is an end in itself, I think the culture has arrived at that place. And also, frankly, now we have ways to interact with all of this that we didn't in the past. I do wonder, pre-social media, whether it's Trump, and I know Trump was around pre-social media. I'd have to go back and look at sort of how we treated him. But Trump or LeVar Ball, I wonder if people would just sort of be like, that's that sort of crazy guy in the corner, like circus sideshow. And now social media has sort of taken it from the sideshow and put it on the center stage, right?
Right.
I will say that I think what LeVar Ball is doing is brilliant in terms of what he is trying to accomplish.
Right.
And obviously it has been if Trump's goal was to be president,
right,
then what Trump did was brilliant. And whether you want to say he's stupid or okay, that's
it was for another a success. Podcast.
It worked. It got him to where he was trying to go. Right. And so I think that actually says more about us as a society than it says about those two individual people.
I do too. And I'm going to throw another variable into this. And that is, you mentioned you got started in 2005 as a digital media person, one of the first. Now you look at Pepsi Center, and it really is. There's one beat reporter for the Denver Post, and there's a bunch of bloggers, and there's a bunch of people that have come up the same way I have, which is through social media and blogging. And now, and I wonder, I know this about myself, and I'm not too proud to say this. I am learning on the fly how to do journalism. I am not a trained journalist, and I don't have anybody that I go to when I have questions, unfortunately. I wish I did, but I don't have anybody that's sort of my advisor. And with covering things like the Big Baller Brand or some of the different storylines that leak out, in a lot of ways, I wonder if there's not the proper gatekeepers anymore for really being able to handle these types of things properly.
Yes, it's so interesting because gatekeepers are important. But, you know, I think we reached a place prior to this, hence the pendulum swinging so far the way it's been swinging now, where it was like, oh, the only person who could comment on the Denver Broncos was sort of Woody Page or Mark Kisla. And it's like, well, this is ridiculous. I mean, nothing against Woody and Mark. I mean, you know, they've built nice careers, and I read them growing up. But it's sort of like, come on, we know that there are other intelligent people that have things to say, right? And so I think the gatekeeping was so tight. I mean, man, I remember when I first got into Pepsi Center, you should have seen some of the looks I was... I mean, there's a guy like Mark J. Spears who was immediately cool to me. He was writing for the Denver Post at the time. He had my back. He was like a mentor. I mean, he was awesome. He was great.
Yeah.
But then almost everyone else sort of looked at me like, oh, who's this guy?
Right.
And now I sort of get the feeling that, you know, if the print journalist comes in, it's sort of, you are looking at him like, who's this dinosaur?
You would be the elder statesman that everybody looked up to if you were back at Pepsi Center now, which is kind of a funny.
I would be the digital Yoda. I don't know. I don't know about all that. I'll tell you though. Granted, Steve Kyler was running the operation, and he did give me a lot of sort of advice and mentoring. Some of it was actually helpful, but sorry, Steve. No, but like it, I did have to learn to do a lot of it on my own. I was on the ground here with nobody else, right? Yeah. And I had to figure a lot of it out on my own. And I think there are benefits to that. I think the end, like, it's free from maybe traditional journalistic dogma in some ways. You're not adhering to certain rules.
Absolutely.
And I think that can be very good. On the other hand, perhaps it's a little unwieldy and teams are still trying to figure out how to deal with this. You know, like the Lakers, I guess, now are barring anyone from interviewing LeVar Ball.
Right.
And I tweeted about this the other day. I thought it was ridiculous. It's like, if you have a sinkhole and you put a tarp over it so no one can see the sinkhole, it doesn't, in some ways it makes things more dangerous, right? Like, I can understand as a reactionary measure. I don't think it's smart, but I understand from a reactionary perspective where the Lakers were coming from. But I think what LeVar Ball and Trump and all these sort of Kardashians and all this stuff is forcing us to do is we have to figure out how we want to respond to all of this,
right?
And I think the early returns are mixed. It's still being negotiated. We're not sure how we're, I mean, are we really going to tell journalists that you can't cover big baller brand, that you can't,
which is an immediate moneymaker, by the way. If I write a LiAngelo Ball fit on the Nuggets article, it's going to be the best article we have all year, just in terms of, I'm not writing that article, but it is that. So that's kind of the weird place I think the media is in.
Yeah, and I think just to, like, to me, and maybe I'm coming from more of the basketball perspective for a second, I mean, and this is what the Lakers projected publicly. They said, you know, they sort of downplayed it. They're like, oh, you know, on that introductory press conference or whatever, it's sort of like LeVar Ball won't be a problem, right?
Right.
And maybe they were taking internal measures. But I look at that and I go, you know, the problem here is that the Lakers didn't have a way of dealing with this prepared ahead of time. Now, that's hard. Who's going to deal with LeVar Ball? I mean, like, this is in some ways uncharted territory. I mean, we've had sort of overactive fathers before, but this is at a new level. And so, but I feel like the Lakers just sort of thought, like, well, we're the Lakers and we'll be able to deal with it. And that's where I think they went wrong. I mean, I don't know how I would have done it. This is a crazy idea. What if you gave him, like, his own show? You know what I mean? Like, on that, whatever that Laker, that Laker Network is, TC, I don't know what the heck it's called, but, you know, like, give LeVar Ball, like, an hour where he just says, like, ridiculous, crazy things, and then, you know, maybe that's a horrible idea, too. maybe Luke Walton would have been fired, like, by Thanksgiving if that were the case. But what I mean is, like, to the best of our understanding, they never talked about anything like that.
Right.
Like, you know, it was just sort of like, oh, we'll be able to handle it. And by the way, the Lakers have done a lot of that over the last few years. It's just sort of like, well, we'll be able to do it because we're the Lakers.
Right.
You know,
they're learning the hard way that things have changed. They're the institution that has had so much success. They are slow to adapt, I think.
Amen.
Hopefully it didn't work. Travis, thank you so much for doing this. This was a long one. I held you for an hour. I really appreciate it. I thought it was an interesting conversation. Is there anything you want to plug before...
You held me for an hour. Like, what people can't see. Yeah, he actually has a weapon, and he was like, yeah. No, it was fantastic. I feel like I could go two more hours. No, I have nothing I want to plug. I just, I'm here for the good conversation, but thank you.
Well, I'll have his Twitter handle in the description so you can follow him if you're so inclined. He comments on a wide variety of topics, which I enjoy. So many people get stuck. I feel like I have all these interests in life and people know me as basketball guy, which is probably appropriate. I am the opposite of the 15-year-old. I do not want fame. I have the perfect level of fame, which is on Stiff's Night Out, people will buy me beers. That's the extent of the fame I want. I want no more fame than this. But thanks so much for coming on, and I'll have to have you on again sometime in the future.
Thanks for listening to the Locked On Nuggets podcast. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes and visit us on the web at denverstiffs.com.